Accession number 23221, Reel 6.
Major Mole, Reel 6.
I just correct that business about the casualties. Well, it doesn't matter, really.
No, you were saying that the casualties were actually heavier than you'd recollected.
Yeah, but I said there that there were four officers, in fact. I could just correct that.
That there were 10 officers and...
Well, there were 10 officers and 176 other ranks missing.
Was there any further significant action while you were in Korea?
No. I could just describe one very small patrol, which... amount?
Yes.
When we moved back again, we were again south of the Imjim. And I remember, then it wasn't clear where the Chinese were.
I think you said you were on the Han River, weren't you?
Yes. Like that. But I remember being sent by Bill Brooks, who then came out and was commanding B. I then left Mortar Platoon and went back to commanding platoon in B Company.
Was it the same platoon as you'd had before?
No, it must have been a different one. And I remember subsequently being told to do a patrol across the river. A night patrol, and the assault pioneer platoon took us across the river, and there were three of us. It was a recce patrol. There was a corporal, myself, and one interpreter, and the recce platoon took us across in assault boats and then remained with the assault boats on the north side of the river. And we were ordered to go about a mile in. I remember going, it was a moonlight night, going up on this patrol. It was a fairly creepy affair. And we went more or less as far as we'd been told to go. But on one occasion, we were walking along this sort of track. And luckily the Korean said, stop, look. And there was an extraordinary sort of... hole had been dug along this track. It was a sort of, and with a hole in it and spikes at the bottom, so it was fortunate that we hadn't actually gone into that.
A booby trap.
A booby trap of some sort.
Apart from the pit with the spikes, did you come across any other signs of enemy activity on that night patrol?
No. Again, it was a question of the Chinese extraordinary ability to just disappear. I think what we should perhaps have done, and I don't know if it was expected of me, but what we perhaps should have done is gone and concealed ourselves somewhere, and then spent the next day in observation, and then come back the following night. I think that's possibly, in hindsight, what we should have done, but we really didn't achieve an awful lot by what we did. Also, it sounded all rather glamorous going across in boats and having people, but it wasn't. We didn't achieve much. I suppose we achieved the sense that there was nobody on the other bank, and we knew for a mile in there wasn't anybody, but apart from that.
Negative information can be as valuable as positive.
Yes, yeah. So it probably was. But I remember Bill Brooks at the time. He was a super guy, and we got on very well together. But I remember being very cross once with him, because had some very fierce sort of, we'd been digging all night or something, and he said, you've got to go on, you've got to get this wire out, you've got to keep on digging. And I said, I'm more or less mutinied, and said, my men are absolutely exhausted, we're not doing any more. He said, you bloody well do, sir. I remember having a frightful row with him, thought I was going to be arrested. Anyway, the next day he said to me, by the way, I made you godfather to my son. And I said, well, I can't be godfather to your son because I've got 12 others or something. He says, bad luck, it's already happened. And that boy is now a full colonel at Shrivenham.
Did you carry on with the digging or did you...
Yes, I certainly carried on with the digging, whatever it was we were doing. But Bill was quite right, of course. He was very experienced. He'd been in fighting in... He was one of the officers who came up He'd got a couple of MCs, and he'd been fighting in Anzio and in Italy, and he was very experienced and just exactly what we needed at that time.
When you went on that patrol, you was yourself and you said the corporal. Did you choose the corporal?
Yes.
Why did you choose him? What qualities? Oh,
because
he
was a chap I got on best with amongst the NCOs, and he was a very bright and splendid chap, and we got on very well together, and I think you want somebody like that on a patrol of that sort.
You mentioned you had an interpreter with you. What sort of fellow was he, and where had he sprung from?
Not sure. Maybe he was one of the porters or somebody who spoke Ukrainian, just in case we did come across somebody. He seemed a nice enough young fellow. And quite good. I mean, he was all for it. He wasn't hanging back, as it were.
Was he armed or was he?
I can't remember if we armed. I'm sure we did arm him. I can't remember. We didn't need him.
When you were doing this patrol, how were you actually moving? What sort of rate of progress were you making?
I think with considerable trepidation, because after all, it was night.
Yes.
And I think we've just walked extremely slowly up this track, which was probably a rather stupid thing to do, because if they were there, that's obviously where they would have been. And surprisingly, in fact, they did put out this extraordinary booby trap. They weren't covering it with fire, but presumably they'd moved back further, and it was just one of these things, I suppose, they'd done.
Did you go on beyond the pit?
Yes, we did go on a bit further, not very much further. Can't remember how far it was up it, in fact, but...
You mentioned it was moonlight. How far could you see in the moonlight?
In my recollection, it was not a very dark night, so we must have been able to see reasonably well. Otherwise, it would have been pointless staggering around in a totally dark night situation. So it must have been reasonably light. I can't remember how far you see, but we could see, I don't know, 100 yards or something. It was quite a clear...
Presumably, even if you can't see things, you can hear things.
Yeah.
You can use your ears.
Yes. So that was really my only experience of a fighting or recce patrol across, and it wasn't particularly brilliant, but I suppose it achieved, as I said, what I was required to do.
What did you think when you were told that the brigade was going to be pulled back and had done its time in Korea?
The whole thing, you mean, when we were finished?
Yes.
I think one of nothing but total delight. I think we were thrilled with it. We'd had a pretty rough time in a way. It'd been a year, I think, I think we were delighted to go back. And we went back to, I remember going back to Busan, wonderful time on the train and getting back. And we stayed in a camp in Busan. And I remember throwing out my long johns, those lovely, thick, heavy long johns which we wore all the time. Two Korean women who seemed to be around at the back of the camp fighting for my long johns, and that's really rather a nice memory.
Saleable commodity.
Saleable. Wearable commodity, I should think, in the cold.
Had you managed to get away on leave at all during that time in Korea?
Yes, I did go on one leave, R&R.
What were the arrangements like for that? What could you
they
do?
They were jolly good. I went with Madame McCord, actually, to Japan. We stayed in, I think it was, there was a leave hotel in Japan, in Tokyo. And we had a wonderful time, Mervyn and I. I remember going to a rather dubious geisha house to see these beautiful geisha girls. I think it's probably just as well if I don't go into too much detail.
Up to you.
No, not up to me. But it was very interesting. No, that break was lovely. And Japan at that time was beautiful. It was in April. No, it couldn't have been in April. It must have been before. It must have been between January and April. And I remember all the cherry blossom out in Japan, in Tokyo, in the parks. It was just beautiful. So therewith ends my memories of Korea.
How did you get back from Korea? Did you come back by troop trip?
Yes, we did. I can't remember what it was, the Daniara or something like that. Yes, we did.
And what happened to you when you got back to United Kingdom?
Well, the battalion If I recall correctly, the battalion, I think the battalion then stopped off in Hong Kong. And I was had been posted as adjutant to the depot in Ballymena. So I went back as adjutant. I'm pretty sure the battalion went to Hong Kong.
Did that entail getting a promotion?
I think I was captain, yes.
What were the duties of the adjutant at the depot at that time?
Well, it was a training depot for the Royal Ulster Rifles, and I suppose, I don't know, it was a discipline, parades, and it was a lovely, lovely barracks, a lovely little place, and great fun, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time there.
What was the state of discipline like? Did you have to take a lot of action?
In Ballymena? No, it was excellent. Of course, we had a lot of recruits at that time. We're talking about 52. Yes, 52, and early 53. A lot of our recruits, at least half, came up from the south. So we had all sorts of southerners as well. And they fitted in perfectly well. And those, you know, the fact they were joining the British Army was of no worry to them. No, it was a very, very pleasant experience being there.
How was it that you transferred to the 1st, 2nd Gurkhas?
Well, I'd been there in Ballymena for a time. I'd commanded the North Irish Brigade Coronation Street Lining Party, and I'd had a really wonderful time. But it became obvious to me that this question of Catholics and Protestants in an Irish regiment was a little more serious than I had thought, and it became much more apparent.
How did that happen? How did it become?
Well, because in Ulster, I mean, whilst I was a soldier, it never really came raised its head apart from that time when I described the funny parade in Colchester.
Yes.
But generally speaking, there was never any feeling that I was aware of. But once one got to Ballymena, you know, there was the gap between Catholics and Protestants. Although there was no trouble, hadn't started, it was constantly being stressed. And I just thought, well, you know, I'm not quite sure that I really want to spend my life, although it had been my father's regiment. And I remember reading through the, whatever it was, as adjutant, and I came across this thing about they wanted officers of the secondment to the Gurkhas, and the pay was much better. And Gerald Rickard, by this time, who had been commanding at Korea, had been sent out to command the 1st, 2nd. So I wrote to him and said I'd like to come and join. Would it be possible to come on secondment? And he wrote back and said, absolutely delighted to have you. So that's how I left them. As soon as my posting was over, I managed to get sent out to Malaya.
How did the Royal Ulster Rifles react to that? Were they happy to let you go out to the Gurkhas?
I don't think they were entirely enamoured of the fact, but I had done my stint, as it were, and it was time I did something else, and I don't think they particularly minded. I don't think they thought I wouldn't come back.
Did you think at that time that you wouldn't come back? Were you thinking of it as a permanent move, or was it temporary relief?
I just thought it would be fun to do something else, and you know, and also I was broke, as like everybody was at that time, and if there was more money involved, I thought it would be a good idea.
What were the 1st, 2nd Gurkhas doing when you joined them in Malaya?
They were actively involved in the jungle. When I arrived, I went to Slim Barracks, which was in Singapore, short time, and then went up to Kuala Lumpur, where I was met, I remember, by a most distinguished-looking chap, very bemedaled and very smartly dressed, who was the adjutant who met me at the station and took me out to Kuala Kubabaru, where we had tactical headquarters. And I stayed there for a certain amount of time and then was posted to support company. And almost straight away, Funny enough, I proposed it to the mortar platoon, because Gerald knew I'd been involved in that. And the mortar platoon then wasn't acting as a mortar platoon, it was acting as a jungle platoon. And I went straight off to them and was sent straight off into the jungle.
Had you had any training in jungle warfare?
Absolutely not. But the training in jungle warfare was on the spot, and your platoon sergeant, who was a splendid character, sort of took me under his wing, although I was in theory platoon commander, he was in fact for the first 6 months or so, I was sort of learning under him. And we patrolled a lot and went out, and it was very interesting.
What was going on in the area in which you were first deployed then, when you were in the jungle?
Well, this is just slightly north of Kuala Lumpur. And there were some bandits around. It wasn't very particularly, this is 53, early 50, late 53, early 54. It wasn't particularly fierce fighting at that particular time in that Selangor area. I think it's Selangor. But there were bandits around, and there were bandit camps. The company commander I was working under was somebody called Doc Evans, and he had a theory the best way to do it was to send in, to sort of search the area by map squares, and so he sort of would send in three platoons, and we'd go into the central area and then fan out. And it was quite a clever idea, in fact, because in that way he subsequently covered all the area of his company. And we did, in fact, find one bandit camp, which was quite exciting. But the bandits had just left, but we didn't know at the time. And it was in a cave. And I remember sending a signal back saying that we eventually found this cave and got into it. And there was a most extraordinary sort of loo in the far corner with a 40-foot drop through the rock face down the bottom. I remember sending a signal back saying we'd found this amazing camp with a 40-foot drop on the loo. And the brigadier at that time was somebody called Henniker, who was a writer and various other things. And he was so intrigued by this, he insisted on coming into the jungle to see the camp. But we must have missed them by about half an hour on that particular occasion. So we didn't actually have any contacts. I didn't at that time.
How big was a map square? What were the dimensions?
No, I can't remember. 1 inch the mile? I don't know what.
So about a square mile, perhaps?
Yeah, I suppose so, yes. Yeah.
And how large was the patrol? What were you talking about? The whole
platoon? The whole platoon. Everything was done basically in platoon. Very seldom did the company go out together as such, or some, if they did. But later on, when I was a company commander, you quite often take the whole company, but normally speaking, it was platoon patrols.
When you went out with a platoon, you were saying you went into the middle of the square and then fanned out. Was this sending out sub...
Yes, you'd send out some... You'd basically make a base near a stream somewhere. Sort of very hard, not make a base, but just situate yourself, and then you'd send out fan patrols out, and it was relatively easy on map reference, relatively easy to see if there had been any movement, because you could usually see if there'd been any cutting or any sort of movement in that particular area. Although the jungle was sort of fairly thick, you could usually tell if something had been there.
What sort of, if you moved in, you set up your, should we call it your patrol base for the sake of argument, what scale of patrols would you send out to search the four corners of the square from there?
Well, you'd probably send out three patrols, each of, say, two or three men, sort of recce patrols, really, and they would go out on a compass bag.
And the rest of you would be in the...
The rest of you would be in, yeah.
Did you put your patrol base area into a state of defence?
No. No, it wasn't that sort of... Well, I mean, you did have sentries. Of course, you had sentries out round your... in that sense, we didn't dig in or anything. You had, say, three sentry posts around. So in that sense, you were in defence. Yes, you always had... And at night, everybody stood too. Everybody knew where their positions were. In case But there was very little, really seriously, there was very little danger of being attacked at night in the jungle, because the jungle darkness was so intense that there was very little chance of...
How long would it take you, roughly, to scour a grid square and get your patrols back in?
Well, we didn't just do it to grid squares, but I suppose a patrol would go out for a couple of hours, something like that. I remember, interestingly enough, on those first patrols, particularly the first few or three, two or three nights in the jungle, nobody had thought of briefing me or talking to me at all about the incredible noises in the jungle, particularly at night. And I remember being absolutely terrified the first night in the jungle, because these appalling screaming noises and terrible clattering and bangs and crash, and I thought, bloody hell, what is this? And I remember sort of talking to the sergeant about it. He roared with laughter. The Gurkha sergeant spent years in the jungle, etc. Was very amused at this young Saab, or Siana Saab, as we were called in those days, was worried and disturbed by these noises. But I always remember they'd be very strong. You know, these funny aspects of things are never explained when you first, well, they obviously are now, but not that time.
Wouldn't count on it.
I wouldn't count on it.
What sort of jungle were you in? Was this primary jungle or secondary? Or
that was fairly primary there. Basically, you'd have rubber estates, and then you go through secondary jungle to get into the edges of the secondary jungle, which was nasty to patrol in, and then straight into the primary jungle, which actually was jolly nice. I mean, on the whole, the primary jungle was quite good, quite relatively clear. Well, I remember in that particular area, there was a leper colony north of Kuala Lumpur. And this camp which we found up in the caves, I think they had been getting food from the leper colony and terrorizing, presumably, the leper colony and getting food from there. I think maybe subsequently went and checked on the leper colony, but it's interesting that there was such a thing as a leper colony.
What were the essential skills about jungle warfare that you needed to learn from your sergeant before you could effectively take over command from him?
I think basically, my personal jungle skills just acquired over the years, in the sense that I think the most important thing was being knowing where you were. And after a time, the maps were quite relatively accurate. And you could, following the contours and working entirely on bearings, map bearings, everything was done on map bearings. I mean, there were no tracks per se marked on the maps, etc. So you would just go follow your bearing, which would be uphill and down dale until you came, and it was basically the streams that indicated that you were in the right direction. If you found the stream was going the wrong direction, that could be somewhat disturbing. But I think that was really the most important aspect of learning, and of course learning to speak Gurkhali, because I couldn't speak them. And in those days the Gurkhas didn't speak English hardly at all, so it was quite a lot of sign language until, and I started to learn very quickly that the best way to learn Gurkhali, of course, was in the jungle.
How did the Gurkha soldiers compare to the Irish soldiers you'd been commanding earlier? What are their sort of characteristics?
Well, of course, they were totally, totally different, because they were extremely respectful. Not to the Irish word, but I mean, they were very respectful of a Saab, in a very nice sort of way, and very helpful. And until, of course, I could speak the language, I really took some time to get to know them. But, I mean, I immediately was totally taken in by the thought they were tremendous chaps and a great fun to be with, an enormous fun.
You wouldn't have a rifleman lunt then in your Gurkha platoon?
No, you wouldn't have a rifleman lunt. He would have been disposed of very quickly by the great thing about the battalion at that time, and possibly less so now, because I think they're much more sophisticated now, was the enormous power of the platoon, of the platoon commanders who were always, apart from people like myself who just come to learn, the company commanders were British officers, the platoon commanders were Gurkha officers, apart from the support company ones, and the second in command of a company and the three QGAs, Queen's Gurkha officers, those four people were the real power in a company. They really knew what was going on, and the platoon sergeants. So it was a tremendous network, and those Gurkha officers and the Gurkha major, who was a sort of senior chap with the CO, they knew exactly what was going on, and they were the people who you really had to work very clearly with and closely with.
Would it be right to say also that the Gurkha soldiers tended to be on average older than the Ulster Rifles would have been?
Certainly the NCOs were older. The riflemen weren't really. I mean, a lot of the riflemen came in enlisted young, and a lot of the riflemen were young, and the NCOs, some of the NCOs were. But they had to, at that time, you had to wait quite a long time to get your first stripe. And so, you know, as you say, some of the riflemen had been around quite a bit, and they were jolly good.
When you found this abandoned camp in the cave, you mentioned there was a long drop loo in it. What other facilities did they...
There wasn't very much in it. Just clearly they'd had a fire in there, and there were a few bits of bedding used from bracken and bamboo and that sort of thing. But apart from that, it wasn't a sort of particularly well. It was just a... I don't suppose it was more than about 10 or 15 men in it at the most.
Did you have intelligence of any value about the enemy in the area before you went into it?
No. The intelligence in that particular area at that time wasn't very good. But the company commander was in fairly frequent meetings with the local OCPD, Officer Commanding Police District, etc., and he would have meetings with him and special branch people, but I don't think at that time there was particularly a tremendous lot of information. Of course, the big thing was to try and get stop the bandits getting food from the villagers, and at that time, just when I'm talking about Templar, I think he was just about then starting to introduce the question of moving people into defended villages, but it just started then.
Did you have anything to do with implementing that plan?
Well, later on, not implementing it, but later on, in the various times I was, we would quite often ambush these defended villages when we got information that there was going to be a food lift or something. Mm-hmm. But it was very, very seldom was successful. You might sit for hours in the ambush and nothing. So after that time, that first few months at Kuala Kumbaburu, the battalion went back to every year. They had a good period of at least 2 or 3 months when they went back to the regimental headquarters, which was in Slim Barracks in Singapore. It was a wonderful place, and they retrained and had a sort of good break and shooting and wonderful parties in the mess and the bands playing, and it was tremendous. And of course then I got a chance to meet all the other officers. And
but during that first 6 months when you were deployed, roughly how frequently would you go out on these patrols to...
I think we'd be out most of the time. I mean, we'd be out, say, for... I think mostly patrols last about 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. And then we'd come back for 2 or 3 days, and the men would play tremendous basketball and wrecks and clean up and such, and then we'd go off on another. It was that sort of... It was fairly active. I mean, the object of these company bases, which were sort of where we were in, which were proper either schools or...